This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
Well, good morning, everybody. I am Glenda Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I am Stacy Westfall from Perrysville, Ohio.
And you're listening to the Stacy Westfall episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for February 4th, 2020. This episode is brought to you by Equithrive. Good morning, Horse World. Well, good morning, everybody. We are here, and this is a brand new episode for you, but we are not here live. We are pre-recording because I am in Key West, Florida today. So we're going to be bringing you episodes all week. We're just not live. And Stacy was kind enough to pre-record this one. So thank you, Stacy.
Oh, you're very welcome. And I know that you're absolutely having a great time and you're thoroughly enjoying the buffet.
And we're thinking about all of you.
That are in the cold.
That's right.
And the snow. <That's right. laughs> I'll be breaking ice out of water buckets while I'm eating
my fifth meal of the day. I'll be thinking about you. But we are looking forward to the cruise coming up. We have a lot of fun stuff planned. And all the listeners now, we're a couple days ahead, and all the listeners now that are going are all posting and getting excited. So it's kind of cool to see.
I have to say, one of these times, I'm going to have to join you.
You are. You would have a blast. You really would. Yeah. You know, going on a cruise is fun, but going with 40 of your friends is even more fun.
That would be horse people, yes. And anything. Like, you just, that network of that common love and that common thing is like amazing.
Yeah, so. And you know, that's what you end up talking about, right?
So. Yeah, well, yeah. While you're eating your fifth dessert, that's you're right. Just discussing exactly. More horses.
They're talking about horses I'm eating. So we got to see each other here in Denver, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. But first, coming up on today's show, we're going to be talking a little bit about careers in the horse world and otherwise. We're also going, because you and I have had a few, we're going to be answering a bunch of listener questions today, like we usually do. And then what did you talk to Jenny about? You recorded that yesterday.
I did, and we discussed the idea of mistakes versus questions, because I have this idea in my mind that, I mean, I do believe that when you're training a horse can make mistakes. Even if the rider gives the cues correctly, the horse can still be confused when it's learning something. But then we just played around with the idea of how you label it a mistake versus a question and kind of what that does to you mentally and how you might respond.
Cool. Can't wait to hear it. Yeah. So we got to see each other. Rare thing. Actually, I got to see 4 or 5 hosts while I was out in Denver, which is kind of cool. We got to hang out for a little bit, and that was fun.
Yes, we should have done a host meetup next time.
And I got to meet your husband. That was fun, too.
Yes.
I mean, I met him once before, but we never got to talk. It was in passing somewhere at some show or another. But so it was kind of neat. What'd you think of Denver this year? And by the way, we're talking about WISA, which is the trade show that we were at. And you were out there. Why do you go out anyway? Why were you there?
So I go out, and like this year, I was hanging out in the Weaver Leather booth, and I design products with Weaver Leather. So when reps for stores, store owners come by and they're looking at adding things to their stores, I can explain to them why I designed the rope halter the way I did, or why I designed something the way that I did. And so that and shopping.
I did see your products there, and I was like, I know her. So, and I did see you were shopping, but this time it was, you were buying tack this time.
I was buying necklaces. And did you see my red gloves?
Yes.
Did I have?
You showed me the red gloves. like
the red gloves have now made an appearance in my new videos that I've been making, because I'm constantly saying, like, you know, look what I'm doing with my right hand, look what I'm doing with my left hand. And now I've got these like really red leather gloves on. I love it.
You the are fringe. A fashion I think that... statement. You had this very fuzzy sweater jackety thing with fringe all over it, and then 85 necklaces. All decked out.
Every time I walked by my favorite booth that sells these really nice, they sell turquoise and all this kind of really nice jewelry at wholesale, and so I kept walking by their booth, and I'd be like, oh, I really need that necklace. And I'd buy it and I'd just put it on. And then I'd go back by the booth and be like, oh, they've got that one on sale. And I'd buy it and put it on. And so, yeah, the day that I saw you, I had a number, a large number of necklaces on and my crazy leather gloves. I think my husband was trying to distance himself from me at that point. He was like, she's gone crazy.
But you did have some interesting outfits at the last. So you did your latest podcast, I saw, was kind of on careers. What prompted that?
Yeah. So, over the years, whether it's been through email or whether it's been face to face at an expo or anywhere that I really interact with the public, by far the number one question that I get over and over again is about becoming a horse trainer. How do I get started? Can I come work for you?
Teenage girl wants to do
that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it's all ages. I get like second career kind of questions and all kinds of it. And so basically, the podcast I originally, this is how it goes. So I say like three podcasts ago that in this season of my podcast, I'm going to explain to people what I'm doing with my horses each week. And then on the podcast, I have to say, yes, so I didn't really ride my horses this week. So yeah, we should just put that out there. Hashtag confession. And I didn't ride them. So here's what was going on and here's how I processed through that. But then I did answer this question from a young lady that had emailed in and she said, I have these 12 questions I'd love to ask you for a school project. And when I originally answered her, I just hit record on an audio file because it was faster for me to just talk out loud and answer them and be really thorough than to start typing because my perfectionism comes out even more in writing. So I'm like, I'll just knock this out. So I did that and I sent it to her. And then when I went to make the podcast and I hadn't ridden my horses, I was like, well, guess we talk about me not riding my horses, even though this is the season of what I'm doing, riding my horses. And then we were talking about career. And so it was fun, especially because I recorded it initially not for everybody. Like speaking directly to Jillian, and you can hear that on the audio, and then turn around. So it was really kind of interesting to, listen to it myself the second time for the podcast stuff.
So you and I've been through a number of careers over the years. You've been in horses since the beginning, or did you like have quote unquote a real job to start?
Well, it kind of depends on where you want to go back to say start, but pretty much if we start when I graduated from college, which was the University of Findlay, an equine college. And so I graduated from there and I went and got that quote unquote real job. And so I got a job actually as a bank teller at a bank. And at that point, I thought I was really
doing that about 2 weeks before you couldn't sit still anymore.
It was funny because I think I was feeling really burned out from the whole horse thing. And that's what I would have labeled it back then. And I'm curious, like if I stopped and thought about it now, I think there was just a lot of change that happens in that time period. So first of all, I graduated from the 4-year college. I moved from Maine to Ohio, went to the 4 years of college, graduated from college, got married less than a month later, up in Maine, and then came back out. And I think I said I was kind of burned out on horses, but realistically, I think I was a little bit lost as to what the next move was and kind of tired about all the previous moves that I'd been making. And so the bank teller job, the sitting down thing, it worked for me pretty well initially. And then I also knew I wanted to have kids, and I knew I wanted to have kids early in my career because physically it was going to require something different of me than my husband. And so I knew I wanted to have the kids on the early side. And so that kind of played a role in it. But as soon as my first child was born, I never went back to another traditional job again.
Got it. So now you've been a trainer all along. I mean, did you start working for somebody else? Were you a working student at one point? Were you working for other people?
Well, I suppose when I was in school, when I was in college, prior to college, I grew up and my mom would give riding lessons and super basic. Like we really didn't know a lot, but we knew how to teach someone the basics. And so I helped with those growing up, and I trained one colt myself before I went to school. And then I went to school, and while I was at school, it's kind of funny because Dan Huss, which he's now famous for, he's the one that the bridle fell off on last year. And the video went viral because he's in the middle of a raining pattern and his bridle breaks, comes apart, like the Chicago screw falls out, and he finishes the run. He was my instructor when I was at school.
Oh, wow.
And so he hired me. So I would have been considered a working student because I worked for him while I was in school. So that would have counted there. And then during the summer, I met Jesse, and he was working for Mike Flaherty, who was a reining horse trainer. And so I got a summer job as kind of, you know, that same working student idea as a summer job like that. And then when I graduated, bank job and first child. And then after the first child, kind of stayed home and did a lot of 4-H riding lessons, a lot of, you know, groundwork. And it's kind of fun because if I dig out the pictures, I've got a photo where I trained a horse to do yearling lunge line, and I was training her while I was pregnant because I wasn't riding, but I could do, you know, groundwork stuff. And I have like winning a yearling lunge line class, and like Jesse's holding my son, and he's like, you know, a month old. So it's kind of fun how woven together it all was. But pretty much just once I came home and stayed home, haven't gone back out again.
All right, I'm a 17-year-old girl, and I come up to you and I say, I'm about to graduate, and I want to work in horses for a living, right? Because that's always the blanket statement. I just want to do something with horses for a living. So what do you tell them?
Well, I'm going to throw this back at you before I totally answer it, because, you know, if I sit here and I think back to my 17-year-old self who thought that with a slight, like I told that to, when I was a junior in high school, my math teacher decided he'd ask everybody what they were going to do after school. And I made the teenager eye roll, like, I want to go to school. I want to ride horses, but you can't go to school for that, insert eye roll. And, you know, like, just kind of like, you can't do that. Like, what I want to do, you can't do. And so even when I discovered that you could do it, which was like 15 minutes later when he sent me up to the, you know, guidance counselor's office to look through those books when we didn't have the internet. But the thing was, like, if I sit here now at age 45 and I think about myself back, even, you know, after I discovered the University of Findlay and knew I was going to go to school for that, I didn't even know myself that well. You know, I didn't know myself that well to know. So I think it's kind of interesting because I say that I've never had another career, but I know also that in the last 20 years, I think I've switched careers as frequently as whatever the statistic is. Like, they used to say every 3 to 4 years that people would switch careers. Have you ever read that before?
Yeah.
If you look at my history, I kind of do that, but I do it like, okay, so the first 3 years was 4-H lessons, and I'm pregnant and having my first son, and I'm pregnant and having my second son, and I'm pregnant and having my third son. They're all very close together. You know, right now they're 21, 20, and 18. So it was pretty much what it sounds like, pregnant and one, pregnant and two, pregnant and three. But inside of the career, even though I stayed inside horses, it's changed and grown. And I think a lot of that comes down to like kind of a self-awareness change and growth and learning. I mean, my skills now are nowhere near the same skills that I had at 25. So I'm kind of happy that my career has changed, even though I'm still inside the same industry. But I'm curious what your perspective is over your career and what you saw shift.
Well, you know, I didn't picture I would be doing any of it. Actually, I you know, when I was asked that question when I was in high school, I wanted to be an FBI agent. Until I figured out that I really didn't like blood and guts all that much. So it was kind of out. And then I was supposed to go to Notre Dame. I was accepted at Notre Dame and was going to go there. And I ended up getting this job selling investments and securities right out of high school. One of my teachers quit teaching that year and went into it and said, you'd be good at this. And I was. So I never went to college. I just kept, you know, I was making $150,000 a year at the age of 20.
You weren't spending $150 a year.
I was.
You're making it.
Oh, I was doing both successfully, which was a mistake. I think it's a mistake to make that much when you're that young, actually. So now that I look back at that, I wish I had some of that. So we, so I ended up doing it, you know, being in the investment world for 15 years. And then we had an acting company. We did that. And, you know, what I believe is that one thing always leads to the next. I believe that everything that you're doing is going to be a stepping stone to the next thing you're going to do. Mm-hmm. You learn something, even if it's a, you know, I worked as a dishwasher and then a cook in high school. And I believe that there are lessons I learned there that led me to be a better salesperson.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being a cook in a really, really busy restaurant, you have to learn, you know, discipline and you have to learn to think on your feet. And, you know, all of those things taught me there. I think the acting company was the best thing I ever did. Learning improv theater, I recommend everybody in the podcasting world. Matter of fact, coming up, we're doing our podcasting conference. And myself and Robin, who was a previous performer, are doing a session on how learning improv acting can help you as a host.
And I so wish I could be there. I'm going to be in Washington at a horse expo. Oh, but I'm with you
anytime.
In spirit.
Come down. You can do the horse thing anytime. So, but it is, I felt that's important that you, it's made me a better interviewer, you know, and I think that's why I'm a good interviewer is because of the lessons we learned doing improv theater. So one thing has always led to the next thing. And I don't think I'd be doing this and it would, Horse Radio Network would be as successful as it is without all those things I'd done before. They all led to this. And I think that's what happens in people's lives. Yes, you do change careers, but what you learned, even being a bank teller, you know, what you learned there, some of that, if you really thought hard about it, applies to things you do now.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Like I used to sit and read books on business and money and investing, not like more, you know, think like Dave Ramsey or that kind of like, you know, just kind of like understanding money. And, you know, it was kind of, it just fit with like, I just got out of school. Now I was like, whoa, there's all these school, you know, loans that are coming due that I don't know that I really understood when I was signing up for them. And so it was like, what am I going to do? Yeah. You know, and you're kind of like, whoa, like for real, like this is no longer like a practice in a high school classroom. And so it was like all that time that I had to study and do that for, I can see it. It's very direct.
So now let's get back to what do we say to the 17-year-old who wants to play horses for a living?
So, you know, that's interesting. I promise this ties back together. The two spots I see people get stuck the most frequently are the 17-year-old girl trying to get started who's afraid she's going to choose the wrong thing. Like, oh no, do I want to go to work for a Western horse trainer or an English horse trainer? Or do I want to go to work, you know, do I want to go down the show horse or the trail horse or the general horse or... And it's like they get stuck trying to make that decision there. And that's a very real stuck spot where they're, and it, but it almost comes down to like a fear of making the wrong choice instead of the freedom of like making a choice and then realizing like one day or one year later, you can change that choice. And then I also see that very same thing paralleled further up the career chain where people are successful and then they stay there when they could actually be even more successful. But you have to step away from something you're well known and good at to step into something new. Because very rarely can you be holding on tightly to both because that just there's a limit. We all have that limit of time and energy level. So I think for the 17-year-old, you know, it's like I at the career conference, I held an equine career conference for 2 different years and in the and so I'm thinking about doing another one this fall, but I really think a lot of what Ginny and I are going to talk about at our at the workshops we're doing in April, July, and October is what really ended up happening at the career conference. And at the career conference, I brought together a whole bunch of people who had careers in the industry, and I tried to split it about half and half between people who did go to college for it and people who did not go to college for it so that it was well represented on both sides of what you could do. And because inside of it, everybody had changed, you know, like that one had been a farrier and then a cutting horse trainer and then an instructor, you know, it's everybody, there was a lot of experience there. But probably the most impactful thing that kind of came out in this one moment that just really sticks with me is this approximately 17-year-old girl who's saying something to the effect of, I know it's going to be hard, so I should just sign up for this you know, there's this trainer down the road, it's close, but, and they're just really hard. But I know, in essence, her question was around the idea of like, it's going to be hard, so I'll just sign up for this really hard thing. And it's like, sign up for the thing you think that's going to be a good fit for you right now and accept that you could change. Like, you don't have to look at it and be like, that guy down the road looks like he's really miserable to work for, but he's close and convenient. That just doesn't even sound like a good recipe. That's not like, don't just be like, it's going to be hard, I might as well go sign up for that kind of hard. Like, it's going to be hard, but make a decision where you're like, you know,
student wherever, it's going to be hard.
Yeah. You're going to be a working student, but if you really, you know, if you really want to shadow a veterinarian because you think that would be fun, then your hard's going to be getting up at some crazy early morning hour and then staying out all day, and go do it for free because you'll still be in less debt than you would be going to college for it. Go, you shadow somebody for however long, there's no cost there. Make yourself super useful. But what's interesting about it is like this feeling of like, what I learned looking back is that there is something to being aware of what makes you excited about something. Like, and I don't mean that, help me out here, because I don't mean like this shallow, like, oh, it's going to be easy and fluffy kind of excited, but there's got to be like some kind of a deeper passion for what you're doing that gets you through the early mornings and the late nights and the hard stuff.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Especially if you're in horses, because that's what it's going to be, right? There's this conversation going around the jumper world now, and you know, especially about the grooms, is that they have such early classes, or they'll wait all day to have their class, which means the grooms get there, get the horses ready at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they might not ride to 5:30, or they might have an evening class where things aren't over to 11. So the groom's been there from 7 in the morning to 11. You know, it's not easy, but you know, you coming back to one of the things you said is also experience a bunch of different things. So you said, do I go Western or do I go English? We'll do both over a period of time, you know, work for the Western for a period of time. And then when you're ready to move on, go work for English. It's just going to make your horsemanship better and going to make you a better all around horse person for whatever you end up doing later. Plus, I think there's more and more jobs in the horse world now than there ever has been, from social media to, you know, different kinds of jobs in the horse world. And that's changed since you and I got, you know, started in this world. That's changed too. There's different kinds of opportunities. Yes, there's still the working student to get started, and then you can train horses, and then you can run a boarding barn and make no money like we did, you know. So that's still a true one. So
that'll be there, that'll stay there. Yeah, just like stall cleaning.
I think that you should try and experience as many different things as you can while you're young, so that everything, again, leads to the next thing, right? So it's always going to lead to that next thing. But you can't look at, I got Max Cochran as a perfect example. Do you know Max?
I don't.
So Max was the groom for the O'Connors. You know the O'Connors.
Yes.
She was groomed for the O'Connors for years, years and years and years and years. And she started as grooming for other people and just is known as the groom, right? And now she has gone from that stepping stone to now being the president of the United States Eventing Association.
Wow.
So one thing led to another. She knows everybody. She knows the insides and out, you know, after being a groom. And then she went on to be a consultant and hosted the Eventing Radio Show for 6-7 years. And then now is the president of the United States Eventing Association. Did she ever think she would do that in a million years? No. You know, she said that. So, you know, one thing always leads to the other, but don't be afraid to try new things. I've been fired once or twice, let go in a layoff round once, and then fired once, outright fired from a job. And both times they led to better things. And they led to things that I wouldn't have quit that job to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that goes back to what you're saying. You get comfortable. And it's not, you know, you're comfortable, but yet you're not, it's not what you would consider the perfect job, but you're comfortable.
Yes.
So you're not going to quit that comfortable to go to try and something that's uncomfortable, which might be better.
Yes.
That's hard human nature thing to do.
That is. And I think that's the further up, you know, I think that's the further down the road problem that I see fairly frequently, you know, like, but back to the younger person that's interested in, you know, learning about the horses, I can already feel, even as we're talking, like this idea that, like, I look at my own, you know, I guess if I were going to say, if I were going to make a resume, then there is that fear, I think, that is put into us by people who are advising us and saying, but it just looks better if you, you know, you stay really focused, you're going to get further. I mean, you're going to get further. You, I think you watch like the little gymnast that starts out when they're 5 years old and they're just honing their skill and honing their skill and honing their skill straight through. And I think there is a piece of something that's happening, whether it's, you know, through schooling or just in the culture, that is saying, you know, make sure you pick the right target, because you need to put, you know, 20 plus years into just this one thing so that you can come out on the other side. But I look back at my resume and I look a little all over the place with, like, again, the training minis and the colt starting and the bareback and bridleless and, like, all over the place. But what I'm doing is I'm staying curious, which makes me want to experiment, as you pointed out, like, what's the obsession with dressage right now? You know, because it's not like I'm going to be making the Olympic team anytime soon. So, okay. But it's a curiosity, yeah. And it's making me excited to do some different things. And it doesn't take away from anything I've learned in a previous, you know, reining or whatever else I was working on. And, but I think that when you're young, I mean, even watching my own kids jump around a little bit, there is that desire to be like, are they going to be okay? they're learning to fly the nest. And then I have that temptation to put that, like, you know, are they going to do it right or wrong? And it's like, well, obviously the answer's wrong, because we're all going to make mistakes.
And there are some people, unlike us, who focus and end up being a doctor in the same field, in the same profession, or a surgeon or whatever, mm-hmm. right? A plumber.
Yes.
And they do it for their whole lives and they're happy. You know, mm-hmm. so I, you know, I think there's that too, you know, and obviously every teenager, quote unquote, that's competing has this dream of being a top professional rider someday. Unfortunately, that's only what 2% of all the riders out there become that. It's like in any other, you know, you're a bicyclist, there's only 1% that are going to end up being professional bicyclists. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you failed. It just meant that your life turned a different course along the way.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, because I think, you know, it's funny, I never wanted to compete. So I never had the desire to be like a top
multiple world champion.
Isn't that the irony of it? That's why I'm pointing it out, because it was funny. I was like, if people would just pay me to ride their horses, I could just stay home. And it was like the horses that would pay consistently, like that works okay. Like I'm in Ohio. That works okay from like April through maybe like August, September. But then most of the people are like, you know, people that are just riding their horse for the summer, or they need their colt started or whatever. They'll keep you fed during that period, but you couldn't keep the horses at the time. It was a lot harder to keep horses over the winter unless they were show horses. And I do totally agree with your idea that things are shifting. So I think people are putting more value on whether it's like the education of their horse or the safety or whatever. But I do know it was way easier to keep the barn full if there were show horses. So I kind of accidentally ended up, I wanted to just ride horses, but not go to shows, because I didn't like I would have told you I didn't like the pressure or the competition.
Well, but we could talk about this all day. So
really?
We need to get some listener questions, and we're going to do that right after we hear from the title sponsor, Thrive.
Did you know that horses with limited access to pasture also have limited access to vitamin E? Vitamin E plays an important role in the function of your horse's muscles and nerves. Plus, it's also an antioxidant. Horses in training, aging horses, and horses that are recovering from certain health issues often require even more. I recently had a blood test run on 4 of my horses, and the 3 that are in training all tested low for vitamin E. Now I am supplementing them with a pelleted natural vitamin E from Equithrive. To learn more about vitamin E and Equithrive's products, please visit equithrive.com.
Time for some listener questions, and we have auditor Nellie that's asking a question. She says, my mare often cross canters during groundwork and while ridden with me and also with my trainer. She has done that since we started her 5 years ago. She was started late as a six-year-old, and it generally took her a while to canter during groundwork. She is overall healthy and sound, and vet checks and sonograms haven't led to any findings, so we're going to rule out of health stuff. Would love Stacy's guidance on how we could help improve that. Per Stacy's standards, she's still in elementary school for most of her training and being ridden five times a week. Well, that's she's truly in elementary school. Does she get out at noon? She usually tries to give her a chance to switch to the right leader self. We usually try and give her a chance to switch to the right leader self, which often works, but it never seems to actually overall improve.
Okay. Well, I'm really glad that she ruled out because, like, as I'm reading the beginning of it, you know, with me, with the trainer, groundwork, and ridden, automatically, my first thing is going to physical. So I'm really glad that she's got all the vet checks and sonograms, which once I hit that, and really even like, so my horse Presto right now, are you aware that I adopted one of those nurse mare foals that's 4 years old now?
No.
Yeah, that'll be a subject for another day.
That sounds like it went well.
It's awesome. It's okay. Like super awesome, but like it's a little bit like asking somebody about their kid. Like if I'm not mindful, like I can launch into like an hour long dissertation on Presto's last 4 years with me. But what's cool about him is that he is a, you know, he's this Appaloosa thoroughbred Percheron cross. He's like big, gangly, just turned four, but he's just. It's kind of fun because he's different than all these little tiny athletic reiners that come out just quick and athletic right off the bat. And I think he's going to be really cool and really amazing. But he comes to mind when I'm reading Nellie's question. And the reason he comes to mind is that, you know, that generally took a while to canter on groundwork, overall healthy, but the changing leads thing. So I see that even in our little reining horses. So they'll be going around, especially when you're lunging them. If you are early on lunging them and you're, let's say that the horse is traveling around you clockwise and you pull on, you know, the lunge line or they pull on you. So either one, like they're pulling to the gate. So they pull on you or you pull on them because you want to move your circle down the arena. Kind of doesn't matter. When there's that contact there, a lot of times the horse will pop and they'll be going around and again, they're pulling towards the gate or they're falling in or you pull on them, something that kind of throws them out of balance that little bit and then they'll pop both leads. And so she's talking about cross cantering. So she's just talking about the hind end going. And what's really interesting is that when I'm first teaching horses to lunge and they don't understand the whole system, you see it a lot more frequently. So I have to be able to deal with it because if you don't deal with it at the beginning when it's happening because they don't have their balance, it can become a habit. But the horses it becomes a habit on way faster are the ones that are just a tiny bit lazy. They don't have to be super lazy. And I'm not saying like hot horses or hotter horses never do it, but the ones that just really want to fall into a habit of doing it tend to be just a tiny bit lazy. Because if you think about it, when they go to do a lead, so let's say they fall out of lead or they slip into that cross canter because they're kind of going along and you pull on them and they kind of lose their balance. And when I say lose their balance, they just kind of come. So instead of staying in this nice elevated, so they could almost be cantering in a way that they would lope over a pole and they've got this collection and they're just kind of like going around. They're lazy, like me jogging and shuffling my feet. I'm just kind of like, technically I'm jogging, but I'm just kind of doing it a little bit lazy. And so they tend to be the ones that will pop out. And then when you give them a chance to fix it, they're like, no thanks. It's like the effort to put myself up in, like, basically it's a half of a lead change and the effort to like get that up and over is a little bit like, no, I don't really feel like that effort either. So those tend to be the ones that will get into this habit more. Two things I see that cause or help aggravate it, I should say, if people that disengage the hip a lot to stop when they're lunging, so they purposely, like, maybe they'll lean over and ask the horse to kind of plant the front end and move the haunches out. Well, if you do that a lot, it would make sense that when the horse is going around and they feel the pull, they're going to go to move the haunches out, which can create an outside lead change, like a change in the hind end to the outside. So assuming that that hasn't been the case, then the other thing is that when that horse pops out a lead, which Presto is just about past, I think, but it was his thing for quite a while because he's growing and he's young. Two things I did. Number one, I did a lot of lunging him over poles, just a single ground pole at first. Now it's kind of funny because he's like this kind of, if he was a human, he'd be like the gangly teenage boy that you're like, wow, he's going to be really good at basketball if he can just not trip over his own feet. Like, that's the stage Presto's in. This horse is older, might not be in that same stage. But Presto right now, he now can lope, trot and lope over four poles in a row. And I noticed it changed his use of his body a lot. And they tend to want to self-correct that lead thing when they're going over the poles, because that lazy, like, I don't feel like lifting myself up enough, the pole encourages him to lift him up. But the other thing that I do with Presto, and I do it with all my horses, if they pop out a lead, I very rarely, like almost never, but I'm not going to say never, but I almost never bring them down to the trot to get them to pick up the canter again when I'm lunging them. We could talk, let's just talk about lunging to keep it simple. But because this usually develops when I'm first doing it lunging, a lot of those lazy horses, they're loping, they pop out a lead in the hind end, they go a little bit, the person brings them down to the trot, and then goes to start them again. But the lazy horse holds on to the, yes, I got half a circle of trot. Like, they almost take the trot as the reward. So what I do instead is I will kick dirt at them and like shake them. You should see me. I'm throwing my arms around the office right now. like throw my arms towards them. Like, I call it squirting them forward, because I kind of want to almost like spook them forward, because they'll suck their butt up underneath them and they'll tend to fix that. And what'll happen is, if they don't fix it, they're going to go like kind of blasting around for half a circle. And then I'm going to have to pull on them, because they're probably getting like a fairly good size circle. And I'll do it again and again, until what happens is their anticipation is they pop out a lead, and then Stacy's going to make them take it up a gear. And it does two things. I get emotional control training done. So like my horses, before I ever get on and want to do any fast ridden circle work, they've already done it on the ground. And they learn to like suck their butt up underneath them and pick it up. Plus, since it's usually lazy horses that are doing this, they learn to get a little snappier because Stacy's running after them. So, yeah. How's that?
That's good. That's good.
Short. There's my short answer for the day.
There you go, Nelly. Kayla asks one that's shorter question, and I'm guessing will not have a shorter answer.
You're catching on.
But it's a common one. Actually, we have this situation here at our farm. What is Stacy's suggestion for herd-bound horses and working horses in an arena or area that horses are coming in and out and going constantly? So we've got a herd-bound horse who likes to pay attention to all of his friends, and you're working in an arena where there's horses all around. I was at down in Wellington over the weekend, and we were at a dressage barn, and it was a massive dressage barn. And there must have been 10 arenas. I mean, it was huge. And wow, there were horses coming in out of every arena. When a horse was coming out, the next one was going in. And I was thinking, how do these horses focus at all? It was like a beehive of activity. And I was thinking, how do they focus with all of this going on? So it kind of ties into that too.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting because I think that sometimes the massive chaos, it kind of just depends on how you look at it, because sometimes it looks like, oh, the massive chaos would be more challenging. But sometimes it's really challenging when you just have two horses, because you've only got the two. And so at the end of the day, what I do is I look at it like the ones that are struggling, they need a little direction. They need that herd leader that's telling them, like, here's what you're supposed to be doing. And so when we were designing the barn here, I actually designed it so that the stalls open up and look into the indoor. And then in the wintertime, I've set up this little round pen in the far end. And so I call it the play pen, because a lot of times around here, it's like either really muddy or icy or some kind of slippery mess that they can't go out. So I turn them out in the play pen and rotate through. And what that does is that ends up creating, I've got horses playing in the round pen, which is literally the only thing separating them from me is the round pen panels that I'm riding in the other end. And then the horses are in the stalls and they're just all this energy. So it's interesting because I kind of wanted to set up the dynamic where it wasn't like they were going to a separate quiet barn when they were done. I wanted that chaos because they get used to it. You know, they get more comfortable with it because it just becomes part of normal. But I do a lot of emotional training on the ground. So I teach them, you know, kind of the classic, like you could whip around them or rub them with plastic bags and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I won't go into detail there, but teach them so that they have that understanding as best you can there. And then I work in tying the horses up, and that can be tying them in the stalls, or I built tie stalls. So I'll take them and that's where they cool down or go if they need like to go stand and learn how to stand quietly. I have tie stalls, but I do a lot of this through cycles of training. So I do a lot of, like if a new horse comes into the barn and it's obviously having trouble settling in because my barn is kind of chaotic, then I would take the horse out, work it for a work session. That might be 10, 15 minutes. I mean, a lot of times my work sessions probably average 15 minutes. Now, if I've got a horse I'm training, I might do, you know, 10 or 15 minutes on this subject, 10 or 15 minutes on this. There might be four of those stacked together and I ride for an hour. But when I want to use it for this purpose of this mental training about this herd bound, I'll work them for like a session. So maybe it's a groundwork session for 15 minutes. I'll go over and tie them up wherever they can be safely tied. That could be in their stall or in the tie stalls. In my old arena, I used to have tie spots in the corners and all around, and that worked out really well, but it drove my husband crazy that they would dig holes in spots. So we compromised with the tie stalls this time. And go tie them there and then work another horse, and they're going to be over there. And what'll usually happen is they kind of are dancing around and everything. And so even if you start in an easy place like your stall, they're kind of dancing around. You'll notice that a horse will stop, prick their ears, and look before they whinny. Like they'll stop for a minute to listen. Like say they're pawing and whinnying, carrying on. They'll stop for a minute just to like.
Which is why the fake whinnies in movies drive me nuts. Because
that's funny. They pause for that moment, and then I'll go untie them really quickly. So basically, I start teaching them, when you stop and stand quietly, I untie you. And that might be I untie you and let you loose for a minute, or it might be I untie you, brush you for a few minutes, take you out and work you for another session. It is crazy how fast you can change the way that they're willing to stand if they start to see this pattern of work, tie, get untied when I'm standing quietly, work, tie, get untied. But it works really well if you can dedicate, you know, a time to it, to where like if I've got an hour to work that horse, I'll do 15 minutes, tie, go work another horse, 15 minutes again. Now that one's up to a half an hour, tie, go work that one again for another 15 minutes. Now that one's up to 45 minutes. Go, you can clean stalls, you can clean tack, you can stack your hay, you can do a lot of stuff, but they will catch on to that pattern, and that changes them faster than anything I've seen, because they start to learn the rule of controlling their own emotions while tied, because that's the only way I'm getting untied. And it works amazing for trailer hauling problems. Like people who are like, my horse drives me crazy, screaming and pawing and whinnying in the trailer. When you teach this at home and then you apply it to the trailer, like you pull into the barn and you don't unload till they pause for that moment, they totally catch on to this amazingly well.
Choosing the right supplements for your horses can often feel like a chore. And you got enough of those. So think Equithrive when it comes to the health and performance of your equine athletes. From clinically proven joint support to essential performance nutrition, Equithrive products are developed with care, backed by science, and ready to go to work for you. So stop wasting your time and your money on unproven products. Equithrive has you covered. Visit equithrive.com today.
Well, Maggie says, would Stacy be willing to be a guinea pig and ride side saddle at Equitana, maybe a head-to-head with Jamie? I like that. We can do barrel racing side saddle or something.
Well, before I agree to this, I have to know, how much experience does Jamie have with side saddle?
About as much as you do. So,
oh, okay. Well, This should be a paid ticketed event.
It
then.
Should. No, me riding side saddle would be the. You can charge extra for that. Well, we'll try to work that out, Maggie. I know That's we funny. Have a lot of listeners that ride side saddle in Lexington, so we could get the horses and the saddles.
Yeah, now I've got this urge to, like, you know, be practicing and,
you know, you
yeah,
can wear a proper skirt. And you'll be all dolled up. You can get all dolled up.
I got the necklaces.
Yeah, you do. You should be safe there. Jay has a question. Is it possible that some horses will never feel comfortable in a bit? I've tried quite a few, and my horses seemed happiest bitless. And then I have another horse that I put in a French Link snaffle, and she is happy as a clam.
Okay. Should I say this on the air?
I think people are very interested in what you particularly have to say about this.
I know. And so what's really interesting is, okay, so first of all, is it possible for some horses to never feel comfortable in a bit? I can totally entertain that idea. I can totally entertain that idea. And I definitely have seen horses that have preferences. One of the biggest things that I'll see is a horse that has a preference for a broken mouthpiece or against a broken mouthpiece. So some of them seem to kind of like it when the bit has moving pieces on it, and some of them don't like it and they like the solidness. And I can't figure out how to ask them why, but it's clear that there could be some preferences. So I can entertain the idea that they would never feel comfortable in a bit, but over the years, I'd say it's pretty rare. And I think the most extreme example that made me question it was a horse that a lady called me back when we used to train a lot of outside horses. And she was like, I have a horse, I'd like you to train it, but I need to know if it's going to be a problem that it has no tongue. And I was like, I need to know why your horse doesn't have a tongue before this can continue. And she was like, it's the craziest thing, but it was running down the hill, like the whole herd was running in to have their dinner and coming down the hill, and it was like slippery, muddy, and the horses have done this all the years and they have to come around the corner of the barn. And this one, she's like, I saw it happen. This one was running, slipped, fell, and like smacked into the end of the corner of the barn. And apparently had its tongue stuck out when it did, and it bit its tongue clean off. She's like, I got the vet right out. I know, it was the craziest thing. I'm like, are you kidding me? And she was like, no. She's like, but you know, that's been over a year ago. It's totally healed.
The worst ways to hurt themselves.
You're just like, yeah, I know. I'm like, how can you make this stuff up? And so I'm like, I need to see this horse.
Imagine how that bled, Stacey.
I cannot. I have thought that. But did you know, like, when I was in college, I think they told us they can lose like 5 gallons of blood. It's like an crazy amount. It would be bad. It would be, that's a lot of blood. So anyway, so I was like, no, for sure, bring the horse. I'm dying to know the answer to this question. Like, I have to know how this is going to work. And so at the time I had some young ladies that were working for me. And so I said, here's the deal. We're going to act like this isn't a problem. We're going to act like this isn't anything different than any other horse. And when you first put bits in horses' mouths, they have different responses. And when I hear this question and what I was saying, like, can I say this on air? I'm going to be brave here. And I'm going to be like, I remember the first time I put a bra on. And I was like, really? This is the rest of my life? Like, are you serious? Like, and so I think sometimes people forget that some of the things we get used to, we weren't quite comfortable with in the beginning. And so I think there's a normal period that I observe with horses where they have this range. But I also understand that if you are the owner of like one horse for 10 years and then you get a second horse, you don't have that much experience. You might not know what a normal range is and what's outside of the normal range. So in my experience, even that one, and the answer at the end of the day was, what was funny when he, you know how horses will kind of like play with the bit by there's this face they'll make, they'll pick up the bit and you can kind of see it up in the corner of their mouth, mm-hmm. and they'll chew and their tongue will move. Well, this horse didn't have a tongue to move like that. So his mouth moved funny. Totally could have freaked you out if you didn't just already choose ahead of time to be like, I'm going to act like this is totally normal. And totally normal means that in generally 2 or 3 weeks, they've settled down. You know, we were working them 5 days a week. Generally, just the exposure, they get used to the idea of carrying the bit in their mouth. They quit messing with it, all is well. And he totally fell right into line with that. And they wrote him. I just talked to her. I ran into her at a festival in the fall. And she was like, totally fine.
And what kind
never
of bit did you use?
Snaffle bit. Snaffle, yeah. Regular Snaffle. I mean, I was like, we are going to act like this is totally normal. And then we put the bit in his mouth and he's pulling it up and it doesn't look anything close to normal when this horse that has no tongue is trying to essentially move the bit around.
I don't know how he eats.
I'm like, just pretend that's normal right there. That is normal for the next 3 weeks. We're all going to pretend that's normal and earn that in that amount of time. It just totally disappeared. So there's a bit of both in that answer, I think.
Wow. Interesting. All right. One more. I got to ask you this one. I'm skipping ahead because I got to ask you this one. Sally asks, my horse slams me with her tail when I go into her stall to pick out at night check, 10:30 p.m. Well, my comment would be maybe she doesn't want to be woken up at 10:30 p.m. Any other time, she doesn't care if I'm there with the pitchfork. It hurts right across the face every time. What can I do to let her know I mean no harm at night, just like during the day? I would just stop. First of all, why are you picking out the stall at 10:30? That's my first question. As a
I
horse
like
husband,
I
as a horse husband,
Sally.
I think that's ridiculous.
I admire Sally for picking them up. Sally can come to my barn at 10:30.
So I would just say, see, my horse husband instinct is just don't do it anymore.
Just don't do it.
It's that simple. It's problem solved. We don't have to do any training. It's just your horse is trying to tell you something. Get out of my stall. I'm sleeping.
Get out of my stall.
I had to put up with you all day long. I don't want to put up with you at night.
That's really
funny. I don't
funny.
Know, Sally, but that's my or a horse. But that's what I'm guessing.
Oh, well, two things. First of all, Gabby, the bay mare that I did a lot of videos with last year, she cracks me up because she's a quarter horse, registered, DNA tested, but you can take her anywhere and people are like, it has to be an Arabian. She's very expressive with her tail, but she can also curl it. Like, I had some endurance riders here that were taking a clinic and they were like, that is totally an Arabian tail. That is, like, she can really do some amazing things. And she cracks me up because last summer, I'd pick out her back feet and like, I thought it was an accident at first. Like I pick up her right back foot. She wraps her tail over on the outside of me. And I'm like, we're just going to call that a coincidence. I go around, pick up her left back foot. She wraps her tail to the outside of me day after day after day. I'm like, what are you doing? This is weird that you're like draping it over me. Like, this is just weird. So, I mean, obviously I think they think about it and they have a plan for different things like that, but I'm fairly simplistic. Like, a lot of with my horses, if that were happening, I would just be like, so I teach my horses to, if I want them to, I can cluck to them and have them move and side pass up against a wall. And then, so let's say that I side pass them up against the back wall and they're facing the hay feeder that's in the back corner. I can side pass them up there and then I can either back them up so they go around to another wall or walk them forward. And I just simply move them along the wall. So I kind of just take away the position where you're in the line of fire. So that's what I would do.
I say just stop going to the stall at 10:30 at night. I like my solution better. And right after this word from our sponsor, we're going to go to our regular guest.
If you'd like to learn more about Equithrive and the products that I'm using, you can visit equithrive.com. If you decide to purchase something, use the word Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, in the checkout to receive 10% off plus free shipping.
Next up, we have my interview with Ginny Talego from the Collaboration Partners. And yeah, we'll just jump straight into our discussion on mistakes versus questions. Hi, Ginny, how are you?
Hey, Stacy and Glenn, I'm doing good.
So what I'd like to talk to you about today is a thought that I was kicking around while I was editing video for my latest course that I'm about to launch. And it is the thought of mistakes versus questions. So you want me to set you up a little bit for this?
Well, yeah, I'm very curious about this.
So basically, I was editing this section of video and I was trying to convey to people that I do believe horses make mistakes. And that's not a criticism, it's just a natural part of learning. So if I started taking a dance course, then you would expect me to take some missteps because, you know, like I'm learning a new course.
Yeah.
And so what occurred to me while I'm putting this course together and I'm teaching is that often when people are here at a clinic and I'm teaching face to face, that the horse will make a mistake. Literally, like you're trying a new technique and the horse just kind of does something that's not desirable. And so what I've trained myself over the years to do is I've been like, oh, it looks like your horse has a question. And it can be kind of funny depending on exactly what the horse is doing. Like, you know, especially if the horse is doing something really animated, like it's like pinning its ears and you're like, ooh, your horse has a question. Like,
you know, really burning question.
Your burning question. So there's, you know, but usually if I phrase it like, oh, your horse has a question or your horse is unclear, then I notice that people tend to be like, more forgiving and it tends to go better. So I'm not sure if I should say I came up with this or if slowly over time humans trained me because I was observing what was happening to them. But the interesting thing is when I was editing this piece of video, it was like, okay, sometimes horses make mistakes because it's just like if you're teaching a young child new like colors and you teach them blue, and they get pretty good at like identifying blue things. And you point at a blue cup and you point at a blue ball. Well, then when you introduce, let's say red, you know, you point at something red and you've told them, but there's that little overlap of time where you can point at something red and you hear them start to say blue and then they change it to red.
Yeah.
Because they start to say the first thing and then they move it to the second. And so what's interesting is like, if something like that happens, I tend to call it a mistake, but sometimes I mix it with the question, like, because what I can feel is the reaction of the human I'm coaching.
Yeah.
This is the subject I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So I think what I'm going to give, like, wrap this up just a little bit more and then ask for your feedback. But so what I've learned is that when I'm coaching and I say, oh, your horse has a question, they tend to be curious and they tend to, you know, be a little more open and a little more, you know, looking at that. And I'm just fascinated with this thought between like how much this phrasing is affecting what's going on in their body. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, just yes. That's all I guess I can say on all of that. Because I think you're right. You know, we've sort of been trained that a mistake is something negative, you know, and it kind of goes along with the word consequence. Like I've explored that a little bit in my work of when someone says, you know, what's the consequence of that action? We have a negative connotation, but the reality is consequence isn't necessarily just a negative. It's just an outcome, you know, of doing something. And so it's interesting how when we're trained to interpret words that way, it definitely has an impact on our body, you know, and how we feel about that and what happens and how we react. I think it's interesting to think about, like, if you're asking the horse to do something and the horse doesn't do exactly what you want, right? It does something maybe way different or a little different, one or the other. How you react to that information certainly can have an impact on you know, how your body reacts too. I would have to think. I know for me, you know, if I'm like, oh my gosh, I made a mistake, you know, I kind of might beat myself up and try to figure out what, you know, what I can do differently. But it's interesting to look at it from the perspective of how we interpret that information and how we respond to it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's interesting because the piece that when you were talking that it made me think of was what I see frequently is people that think my cues must not be clear. And it's not necessarily like back to the red versus blue color thing. It's not really a lack of clarity. It's just kind of a lack of practice on the child's, you know, point. Mm-hmm. They just haven't had enough experience or practice and switching back and forth. And I talk quite frequently about we have to, you know, teach these horses so they can switch gears kind of quickly. So, you know, in a practical kind of a way, like they can spook and recover quickly. Or, you know, it's not necessarily that we need everything to move fast. It's just that first response. But it's kind of interesting if people say their cues must not be clear. What they tend to do is they tend to leave. If they take it on themselves, they're like, oh, I must be asking this wrong. Well, then they just stop asking red. I'll just go back to just asking blue. I'll only ask for blue. Well, you that's fine, but you only get so far when you only ask for blue until you introduce red and go through that learning period of that horse doing it. But when there's something about it because of this whole physical dance of what you're doing, that depending on how the person interprets that, sometimes they put it on themselves and they're like, I must not be clear. Or sometimes they put it on their horse and they're like, this horse is stubborn, you know, and they kind of can mix it all around kind of depending on, I guess, what's going on for them, where the question thing tends to pull them more into like, oh, I could clarify that more for my horse. Oh, you know, how can I, maybe I can, so it doesn't stop them from asking the different color. It kind of asks, it makes them think about how they're asking it, you know, and not necessarily changing the technique, but like maybe more slowly, or maybe just the way they approach it, they just seem to be less tense. So yeah, I think you were telling me a while ago about one of your dog training experiences, and I think it kind of ties together with this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that was part of why I brought that into the conversation around this, because so much of how our bodies react to things, right, with tension, and we're always talking about that with our horses, right, of mm-hmm. how the tension in your body impacts your horse. And but the tension in our bodies comes from our brain.
Yeah.
So we interpret information however we interpret it, and then it, you know, goes through our body. So one thing that was really helpful to me, I had a dog a couple of years ago that we rescued, an Australian Shepherd. His name was Bandit. And Bandit came to us with a fair amount of baggage. And so, you know, I have experience working with rescued Australian Shepherds, but he was a little bit tougher for me because some of his stuff was a little more challenging. And so I sought out a professional person to help me, and I found this wonderful dog behaviorist. And so I took him to her obedience class, and you know, we had spoken obviously before that, and she had met him before that and stuff. So she was aware of him and kind of some of his challenges. And so when I was in her class, she uses positive reinforcement. So it's not that it's not just, oh, the dog always gets treats for everything, but she doesn't use shock collars and things like that. And so one of the things that stood out for me very early on in that class, and that I've carried over with me even 2 years later in other areas of my life, is she said to us, when you ask the dog to do something like sit or lay down and they don't do it, instead of saying no or you know, getting or saying it louder, that's the other thing, right? The dog doesn't sit, and we tend to go sit, 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 you know,
because when learning another language, having somebody scream at you always helps.
It's exactly the same way. It's exactly the same thing. It's like, where's the bathroom? Right. You know, if you're in another country, and the person still doesn't understand what you're saying. And so, but what she taught us was, instead of escalating when you don't get the right answer, she said, just say something like, uh-oh. And I was just so amazed by that. I was like, that's brilliant. You know? Because there's a big difference between saying, no, that's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And saying, uh-oh, oops, let's try again, you know? Yeah. And that way the blame's not going on anybody. It's not necessarily my fault, right? I don't have to look at myself it critically and say, oh my gosh, I must have asked wrong. This is my fault. I'm not being a good owner. I'm, you know, I'm letting my dog down. And the next thing you know, I'm just, you know, beating myself up. But I'm also not blaming the dog, right? It's not like, oh, you dumb dog, you're not sitting when I tell you to sit. It's just simply that in that moment, the dog is learning. And like you were using the example of a child learning different colors. In the learning process, mistakes are going to happen because that's how we start to figure things out. We respond to something and it's like, oh, that didn't work. That wasn't what somebody wanted. Let me try something else. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what the horses are doing, you know, is when we're asking them things and they, you know, maybe don't do exactly what we were asking them. It's a matter of kind of going, uh-oh, okay. Obviously, we just have the communication. Somebody's not understanding. And there's a big difference between not understanding and not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is. And that it's interesting because you were talking about that and it was like, oh yeah, what it does for me is it makes me, I just shift when you go, uh-oh, it makes me think about raising my kids. And yeah, when they're really little, that is what you're doing. Like, you know, you point to the different color, they even say the wrong color and you're like, uh-oh. And they're like, they think, well, that wasn't quite right, but you're right. There wasn't blame assigned or anything like that. But when I bring that over to the horse world and I think about that, there's actually a feeling in my body when I even just play, pretend, remember the color game. And I think about that. And when you say, uh-oh, there's this like almost a positive bubbly energy like this. Yeah. And it's what's interesting is it's attractive to the child. They don't feel like repelled by you.
Right,
I got to get the heck out of here.
Right.
But I think that's what's interesting about the horses is it's, so in the middle of them making mistakes, because I kind of think they do sort of like I know I do, and I think it happens,
but
it doesn't have to become this hugely negative experience where somebody's to blame and all of this stuff, and it's got this lighter energy, and then all of a sudden the learning process just keeps going. So if anybody comes to a clinic and I'm like, uh-oh, I'm going to blame it on you.
Well, I think what you just said, that when we use the word mistake, we tend to place blame.
Yes.
Or we want to place blame, whether it's on ourselves or on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, learning to say, uh-oh, takes that piece away. And so then it makes me curious of, okay, so I wonder what I can do differently, or maybe I'm doing everything right, and it's just the dog is learning, or the horse is learning, or the person is learning.
Exactly.
You know, but it does shift your energy. And what you were just saying is, I mean, if you practice that, just say the word no, and then say, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's a whole different energy behind those words.
Yeah.
And when I'm with my horses, because I started applying that with my horses, and the dog behaviorist got the hugest kick out of that because I told her about that later on. And it really shifted, because now when the horse, you know, I ask the horse to do something and they don't do it, and I go, uh-oh, that's not what I was asking for. And instead of me having this tension in my body that, you know, because if I say the word no or you're bad or whatever, anything negative, your whole body tenses, your jaws clench, your chest tightens, your neck gets tense, your hand, there's so much tension that comes along with those words. And so, you know, just shifting the language that I use creates the opportunity for me to not allow that tension in my body. And my horses are so grateful for that.
Yes. So I think what I'm going to wrap up with is choose your thoughts and your words wisely and pay attention to your body.
Yes. Wise words.
Pretty much summarizes it. And before I let you go, I'm going to say I'm so excited to be doing the workshops with you this summer in April, yes. July, October here in Ohio. If you're interested in getting together with us, you can find more information on that over at my website on stacywestfall.com. And so excited, and I'll talk to you later.
We'll have a great time. Thanks, you guys. See you later.
Stacy, we have time for one more question. Let's get to Rhonda, our legacy listener from Canada. She's a dressage rider, and she says, what's a fun new exercise to warm up an older dressage horse?
Ooh, I this is a good time of year to ask me that, because
the horse says alfalfa. Alfalfa, alfalfa. Great new exercise to warm up an older dressage.
You know, I love looking outside of the discipline. So, you know, I'm not sure if you already add, you know, poles, ground poles, different things like that, but I would go way outside the box. I would go to, I love setting up basically like mini obstacle course things. And we've actually been having some ride days here at my house where we've been inviting lesson students and people that attended clinics to come on a weekend. And I pulled out this big double walled piece of like plastic culvert that's like 12 inches tall. So it's kind of like a big plastic. Anyway, it's something to ride over bales of hay. Basically think like obstacle course, and it doesn't have to be fast or anything, but I mean, trotting your warm up and trotting over. I pulled out all my Amazon boxes after Christmas and made this giant like puddle of Amazon boxes that was collapsed. So there are all these like, you know, I had some other boxes. So some boxes were white and some boxes, but they just sound funny when you ride over them. And then I had the traditional tarp laid out over there. And then my strange culvert, the cat is having a heyday with this culvert piece that I can drag around and poles. And, you know, instead of being like, oh, I'm going to measure all my poles and make sure that they're all exactly the right steps length. Like, no, scatter them and then walk over them gently. Like make it so that it's curious, because it's not all perfectly lined up. And then it's kind of interesting, because then you can use it as a warm up, but then you can also start doing your movements around them, because it's really interesting to do a 10 meter circle around the Amazon boxes between that and the culvert. And then your horse is like, this is a weird day. But it's always so funny when we do this and we drag all this stuff out into the arena. You bring the horse out and you walk through the gate. And keep in mind, they can even see from their stalls, but you walk in the gate and they always look like really perky eared, like, okay, this is going to be a different day. I love that idea with an older horse.
I love this idea in general, because you tend to see dressage riders or jumpers or whatever sticking in their lane, and they don't do that. They, what can I do as a dressage warm up for my dressage horse, right? And I think what you're saying is give their mind a break before you go in, right? You know, change it up a bit. And I love that idea.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, because that little bit of distraction of like the boxes that are sitting over there, the tarp that's sitting over there, and the culvert that's over there, not only does it make it more interesting, but it makes a far better bridge to when you go to a show, because you go to a show and the horse is half distracted at the banner over there, you know, distracted a little bit by the announcer stand, and you're trying to give it direction. So you don't even have to clean up after yourself before you go work on your dressage stuff, because it's like, yeah, you might have to ride it a little bit different when you know you're going to have to like trot over that, you know, set of poles that you left on the ground. But there's nothing wrong with working on, you know, 10 meter circles and then straightening out, you know, and going over something like that. And it'll break up the way you think. And what's fascinating about it is it's a better bridge between that and going to shows, because we ride so consistently at home when we are working on something like dressage. I do it too. We work so consistently on it like that we don't realize that when we get to the show, we ride a little bit different, because my husband turns on the video camera for me and I ride different. And I'm like, still slightly, honestly frustrated by the fact that I'll be like, will you record me? And as soon as he goes to record, I feel myself sit up 1 inch straighter, or do this 1 inch different. And it's like, ugh, like I can't expect my horse to ride the same if I don't even ride the same. So you got to build a bridge both ways. Like then, so I just love it.
Good. Well, very good. And of course you have a podcast where you explain all kinds of this stuff. Tell everybody where they can hear that.
I do. You can find it on any of the podcast players, or you can jump over to stacywestfall.com and find information on the workshops, the brand new course that I'm online course that I'm creating on improving steering and teaching neck reining, and my podcast.
And of course, you can find all of Stacy's past episodes here. Just go to horsesinthemorning.com, scroll down to the middle of the page. You'll see a little banners for all the monthly episodes. Click on Stacy's, and that'll show you all the past episodes that she's done here. Go back and take a listen to those. If you want to become an auditor where you can ask questions of Stacy, you can do that for as little as $3 a month. You can go to become an auditor by going to horseradionetwork.com and scanning down the right side of the page to find the auditor banner. It's simple and it's easy, and you help support the Horse Radio Network and all of the shows that we do. Plus, you get a lot of cool fringe benefits. And I think that's about it for today. Thanks a bunch, Stacy, for doing this. We will have no more live shows the rest of the week. We will have shows for you, but they won't be live. We're going to have a brand new driving show for you. I know on Thursday, Wendy and I got together, so you're going to want to tune in for that. And then I did an interview there, Stacy, while on a wagon being pulled by two Clydesdales.
Nice.
So you're going to hear the clippity-clop of the Clydesdales as we're doing the interview. It was an absolutely beautiful day here in Florida. So I haven't done an interview on carriage in a long time, so that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
You'll hear that in Thursday's show, and then we'll have other shows for you the rest of the week. And next Monday, we'll be back live here. Jamie will be here. We'll be off our cruise, providing we make it back safely. We'll be here doing the shows. Or if we decide, Jennifer and I, to stay on the cruise ship and do another week, I'll let you know that too.
I might have to eat at an honorary buffet in your honor.
Yes, you do. You're going to have to eat. Yeah, but you know, the buffets you're going to find around aren't as good as the cruises.
So, I know.
Yeah. Just but Golden Corral is not quite the same.
Not quite.
All right, everybody. Thanks a bunch. Talk to you soon.